A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. When a true genius appears in the world, you may know him by this sign, that the dunces are all in confederacy against him. Jonathan Swift, Thoughts on Various Subjects, Moral and Diverting. Foreword. Perhaps the best way to introduce this novel, which on my third reading of it astounds me even more than the first, is to tell of my first encounter with it. While I was teaching at Loyola in 1976, I began to get telephone calls from a lady unknown to me. What she proposed was preposterous. It was not that she had written a couple of chapters of a novel and wanted to get into my class. It was that her son, who was dead, had written an entire novel during the early 60s, a big novel, and she wanted me to read it. "Why would I want to do that?" I asked her. "Because it is a great novel," she said. Over the years, I have become very good at getting out of things I don't want to do. And if there ever was something I didn't want to do, this was surely it. To deal with the mother of a dead novelist and, worst of all, to have to read a manuscript that she said was great, and that, as it turned out, was a badly smeared, scarcely readable carbon. But the lady was persistent, and it somehow came to pass that she stood in my office handing me the hefty manuscript. There was no getting out of it. Only one hope remained, that I could read a few pages and that they would be bad enough for me, in good conscience, to read no farther. Usually I can do just that. Indeed, the first paragraph often suffices. My only fear was that this one might not be bad enough, or might be just good enough, so that I would have to keep reading. In this case, I read on, and on. First, with a sinking feeling that it was not bad enough to quit, then with a prickle of interest, then a growing excitement, and finally an incredulity. Surely it was not possible that it was so good. I shall resist the temptation to say what first made me gape, grin, laugh out loud, shake my head in wonderment. Better let the reader make the discovery on his own. Here, at any rate, is Ignatius Riley, without progenitor in any literature I know of, slob extraordinary, a mad Oliver Hardy, a fat Don Quixote, a perverse Thomas Aquinas rolled into one, who is in violent revolt against the entire modern age, lying in his flannel nightshirt in a back bedroom on Constantinople Street in New Orleans, who between gigantic seizures of flatulence and eructations is filling dozens of big chief tablets with invective. His mother thinks he needs to go to work. He does, in a succession of jobs. Each job rapidly escalates into a lunatic adventure, a full-blown disaster. Yet each has, like Don Quixote's, its own eerie logic. His girlfriend, Myrna Minkoff of the Bronx, thinks he needs sex. What happens between Myrna and Ignatius is like no other boy-meets-girl story in my experience. By no means a lesser virtue of Toole's novel is his rendering of the particularities of New Orleans, its back streets, its out-of-the-way neighborhoods, its odd speech, its ethnic whites, and one black in whom Toole has achieved the near impossible, a superb comic character of immense wit and resourcefulness, without the least trace of Rastus minstrelsy.